Welcome. Welcome to our event this evening. My name is Catherine Leary, and I work at Redeemer at the Center for Faith and Work. And I would just like to introduce and thank a few people tonight before we get started. And so, number one, Rolf. Where is Rolf? Rolf Gehling. Rolf is the head of development at Fuller, and he is here with Dr. Mao and coordinating a busy schedule for the two of them for a couple days in New York. All right, he's one of the development people at Fuller. There we go. There we go. Sorry about that. And I'd also like to introduce Bill and Becky Wong. Bill, you want to stand up? And Bill is on the Board of Trustees at Fuller Seminary and is the other reason that Dr. Mao has been able to come and join us here in New York. Bill's coaxed him and twisted his arm and gotten him back to New York to meet all of us here. So we're excited to have this evening. I'm going to open us in prayer, and then we'll have a few announcements, and then we'll get going with the program. So if you can bow your heads in prayer. Heavenly Father, I pray that you bless our time together tonight. There's lots of different vocations and professional people gathered here tonight, bankers and traders and pastors and business people. Lord, I thank you for Dr. Mao and his work in your name as a philosopher, as a theologian, as a leader, and an innovator. I pray that you use him tonight to speak for each person here. As we engage in our busy lives here in New York, we often forget about you. We forget that you're more powerful than all the money on Wall Street. We forget that you're not just holding this fallen world together, but you're in fact renewing it and transforming it, and invite us to be part of that work. Help us open our hearts and minds to hear your truth as Dr. Mao talks with us tonight. And be with him as he leads one of the most influential seminaries in the world and serves as an evangelical statesman with religious leaders around the world. Thank you for your presence here tonight. In your son's name, amen.
Well, welcome. My name is Amanda Walksmith, and I'm one of the leaders for the Financial Services Ministry, which is part of the Center for Faith and Work, which Catherine heads up. And we're very happy to have you with us tonight. And I am particularly happy to have Dr. Mao here because I actually went to Fuller myself. I graduated in 2003. And so, you know, the chance to actually have the president of your school in town and actually as someone who knows your name finally, you know, it's very exciting. First off, I wanted to mention a few things. You'll see on your table that there's some materials about Fuller, about student life, about becoming a student, about the current campaign. And if you can just take a look, we kind of tried to artistically spread them around the room so you can fight one another for materials. And then at each person's seat, there's actually a little white piece of paper, and it lists upcoming financial services events. We have our monthly fellowship coming up on Monday, November 27th at the church office. We have another finance chat about loving your coworkers coming up on Sunday, December 10th. And we also have some other things coming up in the spring, a fun after Christmas party, since everyone has less of a full schedule in January, on January 20th, the Center for Faith and Work Ministry Fair, a conflict management workshop with Jeff Wentling from Credit Suisse, and also Steve Reinemann, the chairman of PepsiCo, will be speaking to us, as well as the marketing and advertising group in February. And also wanted to mention specifically in the first weekend in December will be the first ever Center for Faith and Work retreat at Trinity Lodge in Connecticut. So please sign up. I'm told by Catherine, especially if you're a guy. So, you know, women disregard. I'm just kidding. But anyway, a little bit more about Dr. Mao and Fuller and how I got to Fuller. I specifically chose Fuller. I went to undergrad at Evangel University, which is a Christian college in Springfield, Missouri. And I was a math and literature double major. And I was thinking of going into academia at the time, either Bible or math, and knew I wanted to first go to seminary. And I was asking my professors, where should I go? And unanimously, they declared to me that Fuller was the place that I had to be. And once I got to Fuller, I totally found out why. I got not only engaged in theological studies, I did my master's in Bible and theology there, but I also got really involved in the arts community. I was the literary editor for the literary magazine for Fuller. I was able to sing in the vocal ensemble and work at the arts festival and all sorts of other fun things. And I think it's really when I was at Fuller that I first heard kind of articulated sort of three paradigms that we as Christians can approach when dialoguing with the culture. One being Christ against culture, that Christ and the culture are diametrically opposed and have nothing to say to one another. Secondly, Christ within culture, where culture sort of stands above Christianity and our Christianity is subject to what our culture says. And then thirdly, which is the paradigm that Fuller particularly promotes, Christ transforms culture. And during my time at Fuller, I felt that was really what I was taught how to do. And I think I've used so much of my theological training at Fuller and helping to lead the financial services ministry as we've been developing things, particularly in the last year or two. And to let you know a little more about Fuller, it's based in Pasadena, California, although there are also several remote campuses in Arizona, Northern California, Colorado, and a couple other locations. This total student body is about 4,500. And as Dr. Mao was reminding us yesterday, it's also it's the largest seminary in North America, and it's also the largest Hispanic seminary, the largest Korean American seminary, the largest African American seminary. It's not only a seminary that leads as far as evangelical thinking in North America, but also internationally. And so it really was a fabulous place, I know, for me to spend some time. And if any of you have any questions about Fuller, please talk to myself, to Rolf, to, of course, to Dr. Mao. And a little about Dr. Mao, he actually went to undergrad, I hear, in upstate New York, so he's not completely unfamiliar with New York. He also spent some time studying at Western Theological Seminary in Michigan and the University of Alberta before doing his PhD at the University of Chicago, which I'm happy about because I'm from Chicago. And he spent about 17 years teaching at Calvin College in Michigan before he started on the faculty of Fuller as a professor of Christian philosophy and ethics back in 1985. And in 1993, he became the president of Fuller. And since then, he was just saying he spent about a quarter of the year traveling with his lovely wife, Phyllis, who's right next to him tonight, who also has a background in art history. He has been really a profound thinker. I think I've seen him introduce everyone from Nelson Mandela to Tony Campolo, and I am just so excited to hear what he has to say to us tonight. Thanks.
Thank you, Amanda. I'm just delighted to be here. I have heard so much about not only Redeemer, but also this particular ministry of Redeemer, and I'm a fan of Catherine Leary's and Tim Keller and all of that. So it's just a delight to be here. And to talk to you tonight about, I took the general title of Holy Worldliness. I want to talk about what it means for us to engage in our daily work. And I am going to sort of emphasize financial management, financial services this evening, because that's what most of you are involved in. But what it means for us to understand our work in the context of our larger understanding of the world. And I do want to emphasize that really the worldview comes first. I had gotten into the habit of talking about integrating our faith into our work. And one day I was talking to a person who has taught me much and mentored me much on these kinds of issues and many other things as well. Max DePree, who spent his career as the CEO of the Herman Miller Corporation and longtime trustee at Fuller Seminary. And we were talking one morning, and I said, yeah, tonight I have to give a talk about integrating faith into your work. And he said, oh, well, I'm glad I caught you before you gave that talk, because I think you have it backwards. He said, in fact, I'm going to talk to a group of engineers at noon today, and they asked me, how do you integrate your faith into your work? And he said, that's the wrong way around. He said, that's like asking, how do you integrate your marriage into your sex life? You know? And he said, you don't integrate down, you integrate up. You integrate up to the highest priorities, to your highest values. And so the real direction of integration is not how do we get some of our faith into our work, but rather how do we get our work into the context of our faith and understand it in that broader sense. And so I want to talk about what it means for us in God's world to be engaging in the kind of work that many of you are engaging in every day. And I want to say something about, among other things, this notion of our work as a holy worldliness. I was raised in an environment where to be worldly was a bad thing. It was that Christ against culture, Christ against the world. Anything that was a part of this world was something that we had to distance ourselves from. Actually, in the scriptures, the word world is used in three different senses. One of them is just perfectly neutral. You know? Go into all the world and preach the gospel. And the world there is the geographic expanse. And it's just space. It's just geography. And it's neither good or bad. At least the use of the word there is not meant in either a positive or a negative sense. But there is that negative sense where the Apostle John says in his first epistle, love not the world or the things that are in the world. And we get those regular references in the scriptures in the New Testament to people. Paul says of one of his ex-followers, Demas, he has forsaken me having loved this present world. So there is that negative sense of world. What that refers to is the present sinful order of things, the distortion, the corruption, the perversion of God's good creating designs for the world. But there's a positive sense of world. For God so loved the world, the cosmos, the word Greek there is cosmos. For God so loved the full expanse of created reality that he sent his son into the cosmos, not to condemn the cosmos, but that the cosmos, the world, through him might be saved. And then that great manifesto of Psalm 24, verse 1. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and all who dwell therein. And in that sense, the world is the created order that still is still there. It may be marred by sin. It may be distorted by sin, but it's still his world, and so we can sing, this is my Father's world. He shines in all that's fair. This is my Father's world, and though the wrong seem off so strong, God is the ruler yet. And it's that world, that good creation, that creation that God looked at originally and said, this is good. That's the world that God hopes to redeem and to transform. And we're getting ready for that. The Mennonites have a nice phrase. We're living in the time of God's patience, that God is not yet judging the world, but he's waiting. And the reason why God is waiting is some stuff has to happen. And some of the stuff that has to happen, in addition to the number of the elect being gathered in, and that all people whom God wants to will hear the gospel. But there's also the cultivation of culture. The filling of the world with human culture that can glorify God. And it's that sense of world that I have in mind tonight when I talk about holy worldliness. And so I want to talk about what our work means in the context of God's understanding of the world, the ways in which we can view our daily work, and I want to say it in the financial world, as holy worldliness. And to understand that in our work, that we are under a divine mandate. You know, we talk so much, and I even hear secular people talking about their calling. But you know, what we know is that you don't have a calling unless there's a caller. And we live our lives. A great Greek phrase that, if you don't know any other Greek phrase, this is a good one, coram Deo. We live our lives, coram Deo, before the face of God, in the presence of God. Everything that we do is before the face of God. and that God is calling us to serve him. That the chief end of a human being is to glorify God and to enjoy God forever. And so we live our lives coram Deo, before the face of God, and we're called by God to honor God in all that we do. One of my favorite spiritual writers is A.W. Tozer, and in a nice little meditation he has the idea of what he calls command performance. He points out that the Apostle Paul typically opens his epistles by saying, "Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ." But in 1 Timothy, he adds a phrase that isn't found in any of the other greetings. He says, "Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ by the command of God." And Tozer says, Paul saw his apostolic ministry as a command performance. Yeah. I mean, if for some odd reason, say 50 Cent or Jessica Simpson were invited by the Queen of England to perform in the royal court, you might think that that's just a nice invitation that you can either accept or reject. But even though it may say she invites you, it's a command performance. When it comes from royalty, it's a command performance. And we are in the presence of royalty. And all that we do is a command performance. And then the question is, how do we understand that? And I'd like to get into some just general guidelines and general considerations this evening. And so I'm gonna raise about 6 points, and I won't spend equal time on all of them. But the first is this, that it's important as people who live our lives before the face of God that we see ourselves as representatives in our workplaces as representatives of a Christian worldview, of a Christian worldview that generates certain important virtues that are crucial to the ways in which God wants us to act in the workplace. You know, a number of writers in recent years, Michael Novak, Marianne Glendon, who's a professor of law at Harvard Law School, Daniel Bell in his book, The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, make a kind of three-part distinction that any good social order, any good society has to pay attention to three dimensions, three crucial dimensions. The first is the political. And you can have all kinds of different political systems, but they really boil down to this. It's either democracy or totalitarianism, some form of democracy or some form of totalitarianism. Every social order has to adopt an economy, an economic system. And there are many variations, but it boils down to this. It's either capitalism or socialism. It's either a tightly planned economy or a freer economy. And these writers who make that distinction talk about the different options. You can have, obviously, you can have totalitarian socialism. That was the pattern that's still the pattern in North Korea, for example. And that was the pattern in the previous Marxist economies, communist countries. But you could also have a totalitarian capitalism. That was true, for example, in the Marcos regime in the Philippines. You can have a democratic socialism, which is what we see in places like some of the Scandinavian countries. There are a lot of different options, but many of us believe that the best way is democratic capitalism. That is the merging of democracy and a free market system. And yet, as these writers point out, neither democracy nor capitalism generates its own values. Right now in Russia, for example, the dominant pattern is what some people are calling crony capitalism. A rather corrupt form of capitalism that typically works in terms of bribery and other things, crony capitalism. And capitalism, if all you have is capitalism, why not a free market in drugs? Why not a free market in sexual slavery and other forms of slavery? You have to feed values into capitalism, and you have to feed values into democracy. And so there always has to be a third. Marianne Glendon talks about a three-legged stool. You have And actually, that's a little, I mean, I think it underestimates the importance of this third element. But you have to have all three. And the third is, they call it often ethical or cultural, but I want to say a kind of worldview. Yeah. That unless you have a worldview, unless you have a cultural ethos that generates values and virtues that will be fed into your economic and your political systems, those economic and political systems and the combination of them will be in big trouble. And traditionally, the worldview, the ethos that has been viewed as the healthy one has, and I'm sure this is a mislabeling, but it's been called the Protestant ethic. It's interesting globally that right now in China, one of the most popular textbooks in sociology and economics departments in mainland China right now is Max Weber, the great 19th century pioneer in sociology, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. And it's not because they're all interested in becoming Protestants, but because Max Weber argued that it was really Protestantism, the Reformation, and then Puritanism that generated the ethos that was necessary to provide a moral and ethical infrastructure for the capitalist system. That the Protestant ethic was characterized by such things as honesty, thrift, industry, that you're committed to working hard, things like stewardship, that you you want to take good care of the resources under your management, charity, that you care about other people, and especially needy people, benevolence, that you have a spirit of goodwill toward other people, a commitment to the common good, that you're willing to cooperate with others in the larger culture. And you want your economic activity to contribute to the common good of the larger social order. Those are very, very important virtues. And many in China right now are concerned. I was mentioning last evening, and some of you heard me say this, that we've been told by government officials in that in many urban areas in China, there's increasing divorce rate, there's increasing intergenerational conflict. The kids know who 50 Cent is, and their parents don't even know how to talk to their kids about what they're interested in, and the increasing suicide rate. And there's a concern that the great benefits of the market system will nonetheless bring effects along with them that are negative effects, and unless there's a kind of moral and ethical infrastructure, and what will that look like? Many of these virtues that we talk about here, as a number of people have pointed out, were predated Protestantism, the guilds, the Catholic guilds during the Middle Ages, and many of them also nest very well in a Confucian-oriented system. But there's a lot of concern about these kinds of issues, and we think as Christians have to be aware of the fact that much of the good things that are going on in our culture are borrowed capital from a worldview that people no longer have, and that we're the ones who have to keep that alive. There's a group of sociologists in the 1980s who wrote a book called Habits of the Heart, Robert Bella and his team. It was one of the most best-selling books of written by a group of academics at the time. And they pointed out that much of our ethos is governed by cost-benefit analysis. You know, if we think about torture questions and other things, we just sort of do a cost-benefit analysis. Can we get the goodies that we want to get out of these kinds of strategies? There's also what they call expressive individualism, an ethos and the language that goes with that of human fulfillment, of human potential. And they said that these worldviews associated with cost-benefit analysis, utilitarian cost-benefit analysis, and the human potential movement, they don't provide a solid basis for commitment. They interviewed a lot of people, and there was this one guy who had been married. He got divorced. His second marriage, he said, was wonderful. And he said, you know, in my first marriage, I was concerned about was my job. I was concerned about making money. I was concerned about getting ahead. I ignored my marriage, and I don't blame her for leaving me. But he said, this second marriage now, I really feel fulfilled. She makes me feel good about myself, you know. She makes me feel so human. But then they ask her questions like this. Suppose she was in an accident and became a quadriplegic. Would she still make you feel good about yourself? Would you stay committed to her? And here's what went on. It was clear the guy wanted to say, yeah, I love her. I would stay committed. But his worldview didn't give him any language for saying that. You know? And then they pointed out, the Bella team, that there are two other languages that we're losing, two other discourses that we're losing in our culture. And one is the language of civic virtue. The citizen of the small town in Vermont who works night and day to build the float for the annual 4th of July parade. And why does she do it? Because she loves her town. Yeah. Or the person who goes off to war and is willing to die for his or her country. That strong sense of patriotism. There's a worldview there that nurtures a sense of commitment. But then they said there's even a larger worldview, and that's the biblical worldview, that the chief end of a human being is to glorify God and to enjoy God forever. But they said we're losing the language of that. And then they said, the best hope, and these were not all Christian sociologists, but they said the best hope for American culture is that we keep alive in our churches and our synagogues the language of serving God and being a part of a larger plan for the creation, because that is the most robust way of nurturing a sense of commitment and dedication to the common good. Well, of course, one of the problems is that a lot of time in our worship these days, we're using the language of cost-benefit analysis, health and wealth. You know, boy, I wasn't doing too well financially. I became a Christian, and all of a sudden God really blessed me. And it's kind of neat to be a Christian because you get a lot more money when you're a Christian, you know. Or I feel more fulfilled. And it doesn't get at the costs of discipleship. And the ways in which commitment to the way of discipleship often doesn't feel good. And it often doesn't bring you the goodies that in your very human way you would like to have. But there are times that you have to say, as Job, though he slay me, I will trust him. You know, that's not a health and wealth gospel. Though he slay me, I will trust him. I have thine own way, though. I'm the potter, you're the clay. Mold me and make me. Make me into what you want me to be and not what my human potential yearnings want me to be. And so it's very important that we understand our work in the context of that rich biblical worldview, because in among other things, we are keeping alive the language and the infrastructure that generates the values and the virtues that are necessary for a healthy society. And it's very important that we work on that. So we're representatives of a worldview. Secondly, that we have to see our work in financial management as one important way of fulfilling God's creative purposes. Yeah? That working in finance can be an important way of fulfilling God's creating purposes. And here I've got to go right back to those creating purposes in Genesis 1. The very first speech that God gives to human beings, we sometimes use this in a general sense of the cultural mandate or the creation mandate, but he really tells them three different things. First of all, he says, be fruitful and multiply. That's have babies. Huh? He was telling the first man and the woman, I want you to be fruitful and multiply. I used that phrase in Singapore last year. And I said, so God told Adam and Eve, have babies. And everybody, it was at a business luncheon. Everybody roared. And it turns out that the Singaporean government just a week before had complained about the declining population. And the head of the government said, have babies. And here I was sort of using God to support Singaporean public policy. But be fruitful and multiply. Have babies. Yeah. And then the second thing God says is, fill the earth and subdue it. Now, he's not talking about babies there. You're not supposed to subdue babies. Yeah. So the filling of the earth and the subduing of the earth is something different than having a biological offspring. And then the third, he says, have dominion over it. And I want to talk about the filling and subduing and the having dominion side of things, because in my Reformed tradition, and the one that is very much behind the thinking of this ministry and Redeemer Press, is this idea that that God calls us to engage in cultural formation. That God gives us a mandate to oversee, to participate, and to oversee the work of culture, of cultural formation. And by that, I don't mean just going to operas or going to art museums and the like, although that's certainly a part of it. But it's that more basic sense that H. Richard Niebuhr in his book Christ and Culture used, that culture includes things like language, technology, organizations, management patterns, a lot of different things. Let me illustrate this. So here's Adam and Eve, first day in the garden. God puts them in this garden, and they decide that they're going to organize their lives in terms of, among other things, a primary domestic space. So they pick this nice area under some nice palm trees in the garden. And Eve says to Adam, because they both have dominion, and she wasn't yet cursed and told that she had to submit to her husband so she could give him some orders. So Eve says to Adam, why don't you clear that, all those twigs and leaves off the ground? And so he goes, and he's kicking at some stuff, and she says, no, let me show you. And she goes up, and she pulls a branch off a tree, and she strips it of some of the twigs, and then she says, use this. And he said, great idea. And she says, yes, we'll call this a rake. Huh? And then she says, and you rake today, and I'll rake tomorrow. And we'll do it about this time every day, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because I think they were created in the morning, and it's the first day, so about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, it's very interesting. This notion of a culture of cultural formation says God gave them a primary environment of human beings in a garden with a bunch of animals, okay? But then they added stuff, and look at what she added in just that little transaction, huh? Technology. She took raw nature and she transformed it into a tool. It's not just a branch anymore, but it's a tool. It's a technological instrument. Yeah? Secondly, she initiated a labeling system. We'll call it a rake. A labeling system. Thirdly, distribution of labor. Yeah? You rake today, I'll rake tomorrow. Yeah? Fourthly, a schedule about this time of day. You know, they've already added a bunch of stuff to raw nature. And that's the rudimentary beginnings of cultural formation. And the Lord God gave them that garden so they could add all of that kind of stuff. And then, of course, in Genesis 3, something horrible happened. That they decided they could be their own gods. And they could set up the guidelines and the norms and the values that would guide them in all of that. And that was a distortion and a perversion, and we can see that getting spelled out, because several chapters later, after they're kicked out of the garden, and they have filled the earth with a lot of babies, and those babies have grown up, and then they started saying, let's build a tower that'll get us up to heaven, you know. And that's technology gone bad. Everything from that original, innocent, primal act of creating a tool, now suddenly turns into a project of rebellion against God. So technology can be God-serving, God-glorifying, but it can also be God-dishonoring It could be a way in which we try to run the show. We do what we want. We can manage our own technological affairs. We can manage our own political affairs. We can manage our own economies. We can manage our own sexual relations. We can manage our own entertainment systems and that good stuff. You know, because I think they could have played games in the garden, you know. I mean, imagine playing chess in the garden. Matching their wits against each other as a way of expanding and developing the talents that God had given to each of them, problem solving, all of these kinds of things that would have been involved in the development of culture under sinful conditions become instruments and acts of rebellion against God. And when God chose Israel to be His people, He chose a people who would then begin to reform culture in ways that were obedient to God. Not just in their worship, but in the way they ran their society, the way they built buildings, the way they planted crops, the way they rotated crops. All of these things were a part of an initial desire on God's part to transform culture, to have one community in the world that does it differently than the rest of the world and shows the world what it's like to do all this cultural stuff in obedience to the will of God rather than in rebellion before the face of God. And then in the New Testament, we get that republished. Whatsoever you do in word and deed, do all to the honor and to the glory of God. So that our work then, including our financial management, and I'll get to that in a minute, but including our financial management is one important way of fulfilling God's creative purposes. Three, just to follow up on that, the need to cultivate a theological understanding of our work, a theological understanding of financial services in particular. And I want to say that this flows in one for you folks and the kind of work that you're doing. I think it's directly related to theology in the strictest sense of the word, and that is an understanding of God. Of who God is, the attributes of God. I want to say that financial management, I want to say that venture capitalism, that hedge funds are godly activities. They can be godly, and I want to explain that. I was talking to a theologian friend of mine a couple of years ago, and when those of us who continue to try to work on some scholarly projects get together and we say, I was with Nathan Hatch on Monday, who's president of Wake Forest now. And, you know, what are you working on? Like, he hadn't planned that Wake Forest would have such a good football season, so he's working on the football season. But he's a wonderful historian. But I was talking to a friend a couple of years ago. What are you working on lately? And he said, yeah, I've been working on a theological understanding of hospitality. So that's interesting. Tell me about that. So, well, did you ever think of this? Creation was the first act of hospitality. Yeah. Hospitality is making room for that which you don't have to make room for. Yeah. That's what makes it hospitality. You're creating space. And the same root word goes for hospital, hotel, hospice. They all come from that same root. Offering space. And hospitality is offering space for that which you don't have to offer space to. And he said, God didn't need us. Yeah, God could have been God for all eternity and never had created anything. But God decided to create a space for animals and a world and for people, even though God did not have to. And that was the first act of hospitality. And I thought a lot about that. And I thought, you know, there was kind of a risk in all of that. God as risk taker, a creative act, was a risk-taking act. And it was also an investing of God's self in the finite creation that he had made. It was God as problem solver. And I want to say, let me just take venture capitalism as a case in point. There's a stereotype among many intellectuals that people become capitalists to make money. And my own experience is that that's not the motivating thing. You know, money is a profit is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for working in the market system and investment and the like. But I find that many of my friends in financial services are in it for the creativity and for the risk taking and really for the problem solving. I was talking to one of our trustees recently, and I said, "How's it been going?" He said, "It's pretty good." He said, "2 years ago, I bought this phone company. It was a real loser. I've got it making a profit now, so I'm going to sell it off and find another company, you know, that isn't doing well." I mean, if all he wanted to do is make money, he'd stick with the one that's making money. But what motivated him was he enjoyed the risk taking. He enjoyed the problem solving. He enjoyed the challenges. And in a profound way, that's a God-like activity. God as creative risk taker. God as problem solver. And God gave us the capacity for that, so that in the most edgy stuff in the world of finance, I talked about this to a group of venture capitalists in Orange County, California, about 2 years ago, and we did a couple of sessions on working in venture capitalism as a godly activity. And I want to make a little apology to all of you, and then commend Redeemer in particular on this point. But three of them came to me separately after this discussion of venture capitalism as godly activity, and they said, "Could we do this over? And I bring my pastor to this because he's clueless about what I do, you know." And I want to say the church has not served the financial community well on this. There's often a nervousness, an awkwardness in dealing with people who are in the world of financial services for a lot of reasons. We won't go into it. And I'm just so excited about the fact that this is a flourishing discussion of these theological issues. We're naming the issues. We're taking them on and talking about them in this wonderful program that of which this is just one evening. But the managing of the resources of the creation, I often hear, and Amanda even mentioned this to me in some questions that she posed, "Well, you know, all I do is move money around, you know." And I understand that some of that can get boring, but I want to say it's a crucial part of filling the earth, subduing it, and having dominion over the creation. That is a stewardly management of the resources of the financial resources of God's creation, I think deserves to be given a profound theological understanding as a godly, God-like, God-honoring activity. Fourth, our work must be guided by God's creating and redeeming purposes. Our work must be guided by God's creating and redeeming purposes and understanding thereof. This certainly applies to two different areas and probably a lot more, but one is that our work and our understanding of financial services has to be guided by a love of the non-human creation. If the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and all that dwell therein, it isn't just about people, but it's the world and the world that human beings live in, and that we have to be concerned about the non-human creation. And this is where I think environmental responsibility ought to be one of our key themes as Christians, caretaking. A stewardly concern for the non-human creation. I'll give you a very simple illustration of this, one of my favorite stories. I've been writing for several years a column on beliefnet.com, and this was one that I got, I think, one of the most hits on, is talking about chickens. When I was in graduate school, I saw an advertisement in a church bulletin when we were in Western Canada that a group of farmers called the Christian Farmers Federation of Alberta were going to have their meeting that week to talk about, and this was an intriguing title, Could There Be a Christian Egg Policy for Canada? And this was all new to me, so I decided I'd go sit in on it. And it was great. I mean, they talked about raising chickens and producing eggs, and we can't just think about making money. We got to think about serving people, and we can't just think about serving Canadians. We got to think about, you know, the poor of the two-thirds world and all this. And it was a wonderful discussion. But at one point in the discussion, this farmer, and there was a group of Dutch Calvinists and Mennonite farmers, and this one farmer stood up speaking with a Dutch accent, and the tan ended right here. You know, I mean, you knew this guy spent a lot of time out there. And with his Dutch accent, and he was obviously not a well-educated guy, but he knew his theology. And he said, I hope there are no KFC people here tonight. And if there is, I apologize. But he said, Colonel Sanders wants us to see chickens as little hunks of meat that get bought and sold. He said, but chickens are chickens. And God created chickens not to be hunks of meat. He created them to be chickens. And he says, this means that every chicken has a right to strut his stuff in front of other chickens, you know. And there was something profound about that line, you know. Because he was thinking theologically about what it means to raise chickens. And you know, in a lot of environmental philosophy today, we're getting a lot of New Age stuff where chickens are our brothers and sisters, you know, and we got to bond with chickens and experience the mystical, you know, networking of chickens and human beings and all the rest. And that's a kind of neo-paganism that's crept into the environmental movement. That's one danger. But the other danger is that we see the human creation as there simply to manipulate for whatever purposes we have. And there was something nice about that notion that we had to respect the dignity of chickens, not because they're human beings, but because they're chickens, you know. And that we do have to be concerned about what kind of space we give them. And the mother hogs and their I had a friend who was in Congress, and he'd give a speech in South Dakota, and he forgot the word calf, and he kept talking about baby cows. So I got to be careful about this. But we need to respect God's purposes. Chickens are not human beings, but neither are they mere hunks of meat. They're chickens, and we need to think about the integrity of the creation. And the place of different plants and animals and different aspects of the non-human creation in God's design for things and in our economic activity and in our advocacy of public policy and in our practices having to do with the uses of the creation, the non-human creation, we need to think about God's purposes for His creation. And of course, for human beings, God's concern for people. And here, you know, and Bill Wong and I had a really good discussion at breakfast this morning with another person who's very involved in investment policies and the like about just little kids, you know, around the world. And what it means for us in our work to be concerned about children. This is a big emphasis right now at Fuller Seminary, children at risk around the world. And we're thinking a lot about that. But more generally, the marginalized. You know, I find the classic text in this regard to be Psalm 146. You get a lot of references to the poor and the oppressed, widows and orphans and prisoners and the like. But Psalm 146 is the most comprehensive. It says that the God of Jacob is the God of the widow, the orphan, the prisoner, those who are bowed down under the yoke. It lists a whole bunch of people, the sojourner in the land, and that God is the God of those kinds of people. And that we then are called to align ourselves with the interests and the concerns of those kinds of people. And it's interesting to think about that list because it's not just a random list. There's a unity there. And unless we understand the unity, we can get off into various kinds of mistaken strategies. But, you know, why is God so concerned with the widow and the orphan? Because in an Old Testament society, and indeed in the New Testament as well, the widow and the orphan did not have an adult male to represent them. And in a patriarchal society, and in that particular patriarchal society, only the adult male had the right to speak publicly to those who are in power. So unless you had a man, you were in big trouble. I mean, put it graphically, if one man killed another man and the only witnesses were 500 women, nobody saw it from a legal point of view because a woman was not allowed to give testimony in a court of law. Yeah. This is why Easter Sunday was so important, because both the angel and Jesus said to the women, go tell the apostles. Yeah. In a society where women were not allowed to give evidence, to bear testimony. And in Luke, he says, and when the women came and told the apostles, he said, well, that's just women, you know. So one of the media things that Jesus did on Easter Sunday morning was to change the status of women. The other thing is he broke the law. I don't know if you know this, but the resurrection was illegal for two reasons. One is that the Pilate had put a stone and sealed the seal of Pilate was on the stone. To break that seal was an illegal act. And then he put a squadron of soldiers there, and to attack the soldiers was an illegal act. So the resurrection was the first act of civil disobedience. It was great for a holiday, you know. You liberate women and you break the, you know, you engage in civil disobedience all on a holiday morning. But that's a powerful thing that Jesus came to give voice to people who had no voice. And in the Old Testament, God's concern for the widow and the orphan is that they did not have an adult male. And the God of Jacob then takes up their cause. And the sojourner, you know, if you're in a foreign country, you don't speak the language. And you go around trying to find something, and nobody listens to you, you know. And you feel voiceless. And certainly if you're an illegal immigrant, and nobody takes up your cause, and you're in trouble, you need some things. And questions about the prisoner. In those days, there weren't uniform sentencing patterns. And so you might get put in jail for shoplifting. I mean, you really did something wrong. but you could be rotting yourself forever. And you cry out, and they don't hear you. There's no one who has to take up your cause. And Psalm 146 makes two things clear. One is that the God of Jacob hears the cries of those. That he hears the cries that come from the margins, from the voiceless, from the powerless. And that secondly, we are to take up the cause. You know, because he says at many points, Israel, you had better pay attention to slaves and to sojourners, because you were sojourners and slaves in the land of Egypt, and I heard your cry. You know, you had better hear the orphans, because you were an orphaned people, and you heard my cry. And if you don't take up the cause of the slave and the orphan, where will you stand on the day of judgment? You know, who will be your advocate when you stand on the day of judgment? In that sense, that we in our work have to find ways of being advocates, giving voice to. And of course, we need to find who those people are today, because it isn't just widows, you know. You can take your average multimillionaire widow and say, well, you know, I got to be her advocate, or the orphan children of some mafia don, you know, that isn't exactly, but it's what that list tells us is that we need to be paying attention to those in our own culture who are without voice, who need someone to take up their cause. And that has to be woven into our work. We need to find ways. A very interesting case in point for how this works out in the automobile sales industry. Really fine Christian named Don Flo, who, I don't know if you've ever had Don Flo here, but have you? He will be? Oh, he's terrific. And he owns one of the largest car dealer, automobile dealerships in the South. And he has a policy that you can't argue about price. The price that's listed is the price that you have to pay. And his reasoning as a Christian is that that typically the people who know how to negotiate a better price when there's a process are well-educated men who have access to the internet, and they get that information. So they'll come in and they'll get a lower price. And then if the next customer is an uneducated woman, she's got to bear the burden of the previous sale. And he says, and he uses the Epistle of James here, you know. He says this is the car dealer's version of the Epistle of James. And where James says, you know, the rich man comes in and you give him the best seat in the house, and then when the poor person come in, you put them off on the margins. And he said, when the rich person comes into my dealerships, I want them treated the same way as the poor person who comes in. Now, that's just a little example of somebody who is formulating company policy, a sales policy that is based on something like Psalm 146. You know, you've got to, and the Epistle of James. So we need to think about that. And then fifth, we need to wrestle with specifics. And here I want to get at some of the things that Amanda told me. I still remember your name now, Amanda. That's good. You know, you said that. that she told me, you know, some of you are wrestling with. And I'm emphasizing something that I take with utmost seriousness, and that is that financial services, even moving money around, is a God-honoring activity. It can be a God-honoring activity. But at the same time, so we might say, I'm preaching the intrinsic God-honoring character of the kind of work that we do. That it isn't just, well, I'll take that job to witness to people, or I'll take that job because it gives me enough money to support Billy Graham or Redeemer Church, but that the job itself has to be seen as God-honoring activity. At the same time, I do think there are extrinsic things that go beyond our work, that we need to see the connections between, say, working in finance and these external things. I think, for example, some work can be boring, and I think moving money around can be boring. I mean, there's certainly things that go on in banks that are, for example, that are very boring things to do. Phyllis and I knew somebody who worked in the Heinz pickle factory, and that person's job was to screw the lid on every jar that came through full of pickles, you know. And I want to say, yeah, that can be an important part of being involved in the stewardship of God, you know, providing people with pickles that they enjoy and like. That's a good thing. The earth is the Lord's, and even pickles are a part of what God has created and what God wants human beings to enjoy. But day after day, just, of course, this is all automated now, but, you know, just screwing the lid on the jar as it comes through, it's hard to come away and say, boy, I really served the Lord today, you know, in that. And I can understand that there are aspects of life in financial services that may not always be very exciting, and there may be certain kinds of jobs that aren't, even though they may be strategic jobs in terms of the larger picture. And so much of what we're doing today is segmenting work, and your particular segment of a larger financial service may not be all that exciting and fulfilling. And so there are other factors that we can think of. One is just connecting my work with larger, the larger mission of God's people, you know, so that it is important to think about how the kind of work that I do and what it makes available to me, I can contribute in terms of finances or in terms of sensitivities and talents to the church or to parachurch organizations or to other social service agencies. There's also the way in which we can use our work as platform for larger things. I find that as president of a Fuller Seminary, you know, strictly speaking, signing ads in the New York Times about torture isn't a part of my job description. But given the kind of visibility that comes with being the president of Fuller Seminary, I can then use that as a platform to speak to other kinds of things and to work in certain areas of the of financial services can itself be a platform that gives us credibility, street cred, as it were, to speak out on issues or to take leadership roles in other areas. And applying the talents that that are necessary for my work to other things that are outside of my work. And we can talk more about that, but I think those are also things that we need to think about. And then finally, to nurture a spirituality of work. Max DePree, one of his great phrases in his book, Leadership is an Art, is that it is the first responsibility of a leader to define reality. And that we need to be the definers of reality. That farmer who said chickens are chickens, he was defining reality. That is not coming up with his own definition, but insisting on God's definitions of what's going on. When we pay attention to the voices of the marginalized, we're giving a reality check for people who otherwise might not see what's going on. And it's very important for us to, as people who believe that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and all who dwell therein, that we bring that kind of seeing to our work and challenge the existing definitions, the current definitions of what we are doing and what's going on in the light of our worldview, understanding God's purposes, God's creating and redeeming, renewing purposes in the world. And with that, I'm going to stop and entertain any questions that you have.